Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the driftless area of Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa today with our guest, Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. And as we talk with Reggie, I hope you'll join in. Any questions about the Mississippi River or the land along it? What do you wonder about the ecological health of the area? What kinds of creatures are you seeing in the driftless area streams? You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas at WPR.org, ideas at WPR.org. Reggie McLeod, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's good to be back.
Lots of stories in this new issue of Big River Magazine. Well, there always is. And I will not get through all of them. We'd have to take several hours, I think. But let's talk about herbicides. There was an herbicide applied to control invasive species in the upper Mississippi River this summer. What's the herbicide getting rid of?
Boy, now I'm going to have to look that up. It's a couple plants. There are so many invasive species right now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the plants that have been invading have been from people's backyard ponds or from aquariums. And, you know, people just dump them in the river or into a creek or you know, lake that flows into the river. And once they get in there, if they get a foothold, they can cause a huge amount of damage. And so a lot of people who use the backwaters are kind of on the lookout. And if they see something that doesn't look right, they let the Fish and Wildlife Service or the DNR know about it, and they can get in and spray for those. Now, flowering rush was what they were spraying this year, and that was in pools, small parts of pools 4, 5, 7, and 8. So that's basically between Lake Pepin all the way down to Genoa, Wisconsin. So they were spraying.
And I think they were telling people to avoid those areas.
They don't want them to be eating fish from the area and that when they're applying it. And of course there's going to be some vapor and such in the air too. They don't want to breathe. They were using diquat herbicide on those plants to get rid of them. And then they'll do follow-up studies and, you know, keep an eye on those areas probably for a year or two, because all you need is one or two plants to survive, and then pretty soon they'll pop back up again. So
one interesting, I saw many interesting stories, but one that caught my attention was some little brown bat colonies along the Mississippi and Lake Michigan are recovering from, this battle with white nose syndrome. And the waterways are kind of helping the bats.
Yeah, well, and it sounds like they're not quite sure exactly what's going on. But they are finding bats by waterways, and it seems like the most likely reason is that there are more bugs around water. You know, you get the mayfly hatches and the mosquitoes and those sorts of things. And most of the bats around here, I think pretty much all the bats around here, are mainly eating insects. And, you know, compounding the problem with white nose syndrome is the insect numbers are way down all around the world now. And there are probably several reasons for that. But that makes, you know, that kind of compounds a problem for the bats. Now, we haven't, I often sit outside on the back porch and kind of keep an eye on the backyard. And I haven't seen a single bat out there this summer. And a few years ago, it was full of bats, and we're pretty close to the Mississippi, too. But fortunately, a couple nights ago, we saw one in the house. And there weren't any mosquitoes in the house that I know about. But it was kind of good news and bad news to, yes. to see that guy. He looked pretty healthy, too.
Did you get him out all right, safe and sound?
I did. I'm kind of out of practice now. It took me longer than usual, but we got him out there gently, and he flew away, and hopefully he won't be back in the house. So.
All right. Reggie McLeod, our guest, we're talking about the latest issue of Big River Magazine. I left it in my office, so I don't have September, October, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I was trying to remember. I read through it, and then I went and left it in my office.
Oh, geez. You should. Yeah, I have one right here in front of me. But most of our subscribers won't be getting it. Well, a lot of them will probably get it today and tomorrow, actually.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Well, there's sure a heck of a lot in there. I liked your editorial. You talk about the Upper Mississippi National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. And... I don't know that we often stop to think about what we've got here.
Yeah, people, I think we take it for granted. I mean, we all kind of forget about it, but the refuge stretches from right below the Chippewa, well, actually, it's the middle of the Chippewa River where it flows into the Mississippi River, all the way down to just upstream of the Quad Cities. So that's 261 miles of river. And they manage, I should get it right here, that's a tremendous amount of property that they manage on that. And it's a pretty wild stretch, 240,000 acres. And there's a lot of islands on there and backwaters and so on. And if that refuge hadn't been preserved when it was almost 100 years ago, 98 years ago, actually, to be exact, a lot of that would be in planted to corn. It would be levied off and pumped out so that it could be farmed. So a lot of these islands and backwaters wouldn't be here. And if you go farther down the Mississippi, especially below St. Louis, but there are levee districts, and even there's one big one in the refuge down in Illinois. We wouldn't have all these things. And on compounding that is you can go out in that refuge, and there are all kind, I don't know how many boat ramps, many, many boat ramps, and they're all free. And you can go out there, and you can camp on an island. You don't have to tell anybody or register or pay any fee. And I think you can stay there a couple weeks, and then you could move to another island and stay there for a couple of weeks. And there are a few spaces in the United States, especially, you know, unless you get out in the desert or the Rocky Mountains, where we have land like that, where it's that free, and we have so much wildlife and just open spaces. It's such a beautiful resource. And I think a lot of people that even live on it just use it and kind of take it for granted. So I mentioned that it was 98 years ago that it was turned into a refuge. But I'm on a small committee that's planning to have some celebrations for the 100th anniversary, which will be in 2024. And we're trying to organize not only some celebrations and probably river cleanups and concerts and different things, but we want to get out to the schools and get out to the regular festivals that are in every river community has at least one festival a year, and talk about the refuge and talk about it not only what it is, but really get people thinking about what they want it to be in 100 years, you know, to speculate and to understand how it has changed in the 100 years that it's been in existence. So that's kind of an exciting time. And, you know, I've lived on the refuge for almost 50 years now, and it's a big part of my life. It has been ever since I moved here, and that's true for a lot of people that live on it. Especially the smaller towns, a lot of these small river towns, a good share of the people are living in those towns, not because there's a college there or a shopping mall or, you know, anything like that. They're living there because of the refuge and the river being the way it is and being such an incredible resource.
Oh, man, it's just I was just thinking back and saying, boy, man, I'm so thankful that our legislators at the time had the foresight to pass the legislation.
Yeah, one guy gets a lot of the credit, Will Dilg, and he was a sportsman from Chicago that liked to fish for bass around McGregor, Iowa, in that area by Prairie du Chien. And he organized with a few other guys, and they went out to Washington and lobbied and got the bill passed. I think it was in 1 day or 2 days, which would never, ever, ever happen in the 21st century, of course. If you did it in 1 or 2 years, it would be pretty good work. But these guys just did it, like, almost immediately. It was such a good idea, and I think that the legislators recognized that, and these guys must have been pretty articulate spokespeople. But it's an amazing story. It's really an amazing story.
Yeah, you tell it well. In July, the Minnesota-based Carpenter Nature Center opened a location in Hudson.
Yeah, they've always had the location there, but it's just been some land, you know, with a parking lot, basically. And they've had programs there, but now they actually have a visitor center with displays, and they're doing more programs and events there because they didn't do a lot over there before. So that's really neat, and it's kind of interesting that they're in both states. And they have a long history on the Minnesota side, and the land in the Minnesota side was an apple orchard, much of it was. So they even have a big apple sale in the fall to raise money. They still take care of the orchard, and that's central to some of their activities throughout the year. But yeah, the center in Wisconsin is very nice, and they aim a lot of their programs at families and kids. So with the center over there, they're going to be doing a lot more, and it's a cool place to visit.
If I may be remembering this wrong, but wasn't it a farm family that donated that property over on the Wisconsin side?
Yes, yes. And I don't remember the name of the family offhand, but yeah.
Nice donation.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of. There's been a lot of that happening in Wisconsin. You know, the Mississippi Valley Conservancy in La Crosse now manages a lot of land that was donated by farm families or part of the land or access to the land. There are all different sorts of arrangements that landowners can make to take care of properties. And there's a big property on the Kickapoo River that was donated this year on Plum Creek. That's adjacent to some state land too, and there's a lot of public land along the Kickapoo, and that's a big deal too. So that generosity is a lot of people are enjoying that the generosity of these families that have thought to do this.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We're talking about the September-October issue of the magazine. You may have some questions about life along the Mississippi. Do you live along the Mississippi? What are some of your favorite parts of the Driftless area? Wildlife observations? I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Tyler Ditter's our engineer today, Clara Neipert, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at life along the Mississippi River with Reggie McLeod, editor of Big and publisher of Big River Magazine. Great magazine. I really enjoyed. Reggie, how do we get copies of that? How do you subscribe?
Well, anyone can visit our website at bigrivermagazine.com or they can call us at 1-800-303-8201 and subscribe or just see what's going on. We've got a lot of free resources on our website that they can check with weather and different things. And we have some articles from back issues up there that they can look at and read. So, check it out.
There's a lot on your website and a lot in the magazine. So it's really cool. The Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin is trying to make a conservation plan in the Driftless area. What would that plan protect?
Well, the Driftless area is a geological region, and it's an area that has steep bluffs and a lot of karst topography. And karst topography is a type of limestone topography with sandstone too, where the sandstone and the limestone has eroded out over time. So there's a lot of deep fissures in the rock, a lot of caves, sinkholes, and so on. So some of the issues with land use and with groundwater and runoff and thin soil and so on are really unique to the Driftless area. So the Driftless area of Wisconsin, and it's in four states actually, but almost a half of it, the whole Driftless area is in Wisconsin, and it goes almost over to Madison and of course from the Illinois border up almost to the St. Croix River, pretty close to the St. Croix River. And so the formation of this organization is to really look at the uniqueness of some of these issues dealing with land use and water, I think, principally, but endangered species also come into play and that sort of thing, and come up with kind of a long-term plan to maybe deal with some of those things a little better, to understand some of those issues a little better, and to really kind of acknowledge the uniqueness of this area when you compare it to the rest of the surrounding land, where glaciers covered all of the land around the Driftless area during the last glacial age, the Wisconsin glaciers. Actually, they weren't just in Wisconsin, but the glaciers even went south of the Driftless area. So the Driftless area was a little island in terms of the a lot of the wildlife and plants and so on, but also those glaciers kind of ground down a lot of the topography, so it was a lot flatter, and the Driftless area, you know, remained and kept all these steep bluffs and deep valleys, and
beautiful place,
caves and everything. Yeah, I agree.
Ryan in Prairie du Chien, we'll give you a chance now. Thanks for calling, Ryan.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. You know, I'm a native of Victory, Wisconsin, Reggie. I don't know if you know where that is.
Well, yeah, of course.
Very, very kind of dark history there, right?
Sure.
The Blackhawk War, but that's probably why I became a history teacher. I teach history in the Prairie du Chien area now, but a friend of mine just got done making a documentary, and it aired in Prairie du Chien called Life in a River Town. And he did a really good job with it. His name is Dan Morris. I'm sure he's going to try to get it public. It's the trailer's on YouTube. You know, they're selling DVDs by the Prairie du Chien Chamber of Commerce and stuff like that. But it's something you might want to check out, Reggie, because he just hits it right on the head. People live here because of what they do on the river. They're not here for any other reason, you know. And having grown up around here and been lucky enough to get a job right down the river from where I was from, I feel very fortunate. And we all share the same concerns about the runoff and about the integrity of the agriculture in the area. And I'm just really glad for your program. I'm glad to hear it. So thank you.
Ryan, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. I am going to have to get a copy of that and look at it, and maybe we can get a review in the magazine, because I hadn't heard of that before. Thanks, Ryan.
Yeah, Life in a River Town, I think, was the title of the film, and probably at least get a quick view of it
He said it was on the web, but we could put a link to it on our Facebook page, which people can also access. We put news, things that come up, breaking news sometimes on our Facebook page. So if we can get a link to that, we'll put it up there today.
All right, Ryan, you heard that.
Yeah.
Send Reggie a link to that, and we can get that up there on the Facebook page. Thank you again for calling. Dennis in Dubuque, Iowa. We'll go to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. Larry, you interviewed someone that wrote the book, The Last Muskrat on the River. And I don't know, I remember the interview, I think. I don't know if he's still living or if his wife is still living. And what impact did he have on any of the conservation?
Hmm. Reggie, I'm sure you know who Dennis is talking about.
Yeah, that would be Mr. Solway, the last river rat. And he wrote the book, The Last River Rat, and he wrote a couple other books, and he really had a breakthrough. A film crew from BBC came out here and did a documentary on him that appeared in on BBC in Great Britain, and it won awards over there, and it came over here in the Discovery Channel, presented it over here, and it won a number of awards over here. And actually, I just was drinking beer with the sound man a couple weeks ago. They came back with his family. They kind of fell in love with the area and came back here for their vacation this summer. So Kenny Solway is who you're speaking of, and he lives over by Alma. He's pretty much retired from. Well, I wish we could get him to write some more for us.
Yeah.
He started off actually as a writer doing a column for us in Big River, and he spoke at Canucopia every year. In fact, they gave him like a 2-hour block to speak in. I think he was so popular, and
he's a great guy. He was a lot of fun to I think I interviewed him 3 times probably, or maybe each time he had a book out. I can't remember now.
Yeah. We were on together once. We were on the show together once, which was a lot of fun. In fact, he back before I even started Big River, I wrote a newspaper article about him that was in the Milwaukee Journal or the Sentinel and some other papers, and it was kind of a breakthrough for him, and I'd forgotten about that, and he brought it up in the show. And that was his books are still out there. You can find them. He did a nice DVD where he's actually reading his stories. I mean, it's a CD where he's reading his stories. And nobody, he's a wonderful storyteller. I mean, that's why he did a lot of live presentations. He was very popular with those, so...
Yeah, Dennis. Kenny Solway. Thank you, Dennis, for bringing that up. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I was interested in an article. Well, last month, the U.S. Geological Survey and partners published a report on the ecological status of the Upper Mississippi and the Illinois Rivers. What are your biggest takeaways from that report?
Well, that's really fascinating, and I'm going to be using that for stories probably for the next year anyway. The most interesting thing to me was this report covers what's kind of a 5-state coalition that has been, in fact, there are several different related coalitions that work together on issues with the river. And it's not only the driftless states of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois, but it's also Missouri. And so they include even the stretch of river just below the last dam on the Mississippi River, you know, below St. Louis, which is still Illinois, Missouri. And they also include the Illinois River, which is extremely polluted.
Yeah.
River pilots call it the ditch, actually. That's their nickname for it, is the ditch. and it's full of silver carp and so on. So it was interesting seeing how we are doing in our stretch, but also comparing it to the impounded areas and the Illinois River. Things are pretty good up here. A lot of things are in decline. The two things that I'm most concerned about, and they've been one's been a long-term problem, and that's that the backwaters are filling in slowly. And that started happening when they built the lock and dam system in the 1930s. And they're really not doing anything significant about it. They do small projects and do dredging and island building and do a lot of PR about it. But that really only affects a very small part of the upper river. And we're talking mostly about the Upper Mississippi Refuge. So that's slowly dying from being silted in because fish need deep holes to overwinter in. They can't survive in shallow water because it gets too cold and it runs out of oxygen and so on. And that problem has never been seriously addressed, in my opinion. And that's one of the findings in here, and they've been talking about it, writing about it, and studying it and measuring it for many decades. The other problem is more recent, and that's a huge share of the trees have died in the bottomland forests of the river. There's two reasons for that. One is the main tree down there now is the green ash. Yeah, yeah. And the ash borers have killed off, more than half, I think, the green ash down there now. And then we had 4 years of extremely high water, where the water stayed high year-round. And the last of those years was 2019. During that year, the total amount of water that flowed down this part of the river during the whole year was 30% more than had ever been recorded before, which is just a stunning change. And that killed a huge share of the trees. And because we've had lower water the last 3 years after that, some of the trees have kept putting out leaves, but they are basically dead, you know. And it takes a few years for them to die sometimes when they've been damaged that badly. So there's a lot of dead trees out there. And I've been talking to one of our writers, Ted Peck, who is a fishing guide out of New Albany, Iowa. He's really concerned that all these dead trees are falling in the water and it's causing the islands to erode faster. And if we get, and we've been talking about this for the last couple of weeks a lot, if we get a year or two of really high water, it's going to sweep a lot of those trees into the main channel, and it's going to be a mess because some of these, you can look at some of the backwaters and all the trees are dead. Acres and acres of trees are dead. It's good for the woodpeckers, I'll say that. But it's really going to have some serious consequences. And then this might be a permanent thing with climate change. It might be that just the trees and islands and all this are going to have to change, and you know, that could take decades. We don't know how it might change. A lot of times reed canary grass and some of these other plants are not necessarily invasive. Some are, some aren't. They create such a thick layer when the tree underneath the trees when they die that you don't have any new seedlings starting. So a lot of these islands and backwaters where all the trees are dead may not be reforested for a long time unless they go in and do it deliberately. And when you're talking about 240,000 acres just in the refuge, you know, it's hard to get in and have much effect with, you know, human labor and machinery and all that. I mean, it's a lot of land and it's swampy and muddy and a dramatic change. And when I go out and paddle the backwaters or fish, they've totally changed from like 6 or 7 years ago. The channels have changed. The sandbars have changed. There are trees in the water all over the place. Channels are blocked. New channels are open. I mean, Larry, it's really been through some dramatic changes. So this study looked at, like, I think 30 years of changes or almost 30 years. But the more dramatic stuff has happened in the last 7 to 10 years. And of course, climate change has gotten more dramatic, too, in those years. So
there's, on the maybe brighter side, there's a new variety of wheatgrass out there called Kernza.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's grabbing a lot of attention of farmers, of brewers, and environmentalists. All are interested in it. And this plant has some potential to help the environment out.
Yeah, this is good news, and it could be a really big deal because most of our crops, like in the Driftless area and in the upper Midwest, we're talking about corn and soybeans. And a little farther west, they grow a lot of wheat. And those are all annual crops. So, you know, you have to plow every year, even if it's just chisel plowing. You have to work the soil every year and, you know, spray herbicides and plant. And then the plants only grow for one season, so the roots don't go down very far. They might only go down a couple feet, you know. Then you start all over again. And Kernza, they've been trying to develop a perennial corn, actually, too, and a perennial wheat for years. And perennial means that you plant it and it will grow for years. And they haven't had much success with corn, but this Kernza is a perennial wheat that is productive for several years, and the roots can go down, you know, 20 feet. And that means that it holds the soil in place. You have less erosion and runoff because you're not plowing the land every year. It also means that during these drought years and with climate change, it seems like a lot of places are either too wet or too dry every year. So it's more resilient, you know, if during drought. And also the mass of those roots, when they die, that becomes organic matter in the soil. So it really enriches the soil. And it kind of breaks up the hard pan. It makes the soil, you know, more crumbly so that other things can grow in it more easily. And it tastes good.
More importantly,
it tastes good. And you can buy things that use Kernza wheat in it. And actually, even Driftless Brewing over in Soldier's Grove has made several beers. We've got to mention that. Out of Kernza that are good. And I really, when Steve Gardner turned this article in and I saw that, I was looking all over town in La Crosse and that for some Kernza beer, and I think these are small batches, but I haven't tasted it. But he was at a Kernza festival up on Lake Pepin in Lake City, Minnesota, where they were serving Kernza beer, and he tells me it's pretty good.
Well, as soon as I read that, I wanted to try it, of course.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, of course.
Well, Reggie McLeod, our guest today, you know, I was one thing you did mention, and just a short article on it in your magazine about a silver. You mentioned silver carp, and it reminded me of the silver carp that they found that had traveled 35 miles through several lakes and stopped finally at Dam 5. We couldn't get over Dam 5.
Yeah. They've really kept an eye on the silver carp up here, and now they're putting little transmitters in them and releasing them and then tracking them. And they're trying to find out how far they can travel in a given time. And this guy covered a lot of, I won't say a lot of ground, covered a lot of water in a very short time. And so they're very mobile. The thing that...
And we don't want them.
We don't. But the good news is, I don't want to be... I've got to be really a bummer on that report. But the good news is they haven't found a reproducing population up in this stretch of the river. And a lot of the biologists, fisheries people and that, speculate, because it'd be hard to prove, but they believe that if a healthy ecosystem kind of keeps them out, and they have a harder time getting a foothold and reproducing if they have a lot of competition from the native fish, and if the native plant community is healthy and all of that, it's an impediment to them getting a foothold. And like I said, the place where they're thickest, where they make up most of the fish mass, well over 50% of the fish mass, is down in the lower Illinois River, the ditch, which was a river that really got beat up, and it's got levees along most of it, and levee districts and all of this, and they've really got a foothold, and they've got a healthy reproducing population down there. So, but they're keeping a close eye on them up here, and frankly, you know, people are frightened about what could happen if they do get a foothold up here, because they can be very competitive if they start reproducing.
Jim in Madison, we give you a chance. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Just first, I'm sorry to hear about the loss of the trees on those islands out in the backwaters out there. That's sad to hear. But I just wanted to kind of maybe make a comment to people who live in Wisconsin and Minnesota, just how wonderful that area is. I mean, it's like you go along there, it's like you're totally away from Wisconsin. It's a whole different area. Where you cross the river some places where it takes some miles to go from one bank and then across the, you know, the lowlands there and the backwaters of the Mississippi before you get to the other side. And then, of course, the bluff, if you can get up on top of that and look down the river, it's just incredible. It's a wonderful area of Wisconsin. I hope people are all aware of it. But my question is, I'm just curious, is why did the driftless area happen? Why did the glaciers not cover or kind of gouge out that particular area?
I don't know if they're really certain, but it seems as though the Baraboo Ridge, which is a ridge of harder stone, might have deflected some of the movement of the glaciers, because as the glaciers become heavier, they kind of flatten out under their own weight and kind of move forward and push stones and soil in front of them. And the Baraboo Ridge might have been part of the reason that it kind of deflected them around. But it is kind of hard to understand how the glaciers could go south, you know, how they could take a turn. But some of it is there were a number of glaciers in that period, and they moved in slightly different directions over that period. And I think that's what happened, because that glacial period was going on for thousands and thousands of years. So over the course of that, they got around the south part of it, some of them.
Well, on that note, here we are out of time. Again, Reggie, what's your website address and for ordering magazines and so forth?
BigRiverMagazine.com, and I should say, visit some bluff overlooks if you can this fall. We should have mentioned that. This is a good time of year to do that. And they can also call 1-800-303-8201.
Always a pleasure, Reggie. We didn't cover half of what you've got in the magazine this time around, but it's always fun to talk about life on the Mississippi and the surrounding lands. Thank you again.
Okay, thank you, Larry. I always enjoy this a lot.
Reggie McLeod, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Always fun talking with him, and he'll probably be back in a couple of months when another issue comes out. But we're going to turn our attention to farmland preservation next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.